stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to talk about how you can discover qualities which you may have had to hide, to be in denial for, and which you might now want to recover. I'm also playing an interview I did with the really interesting Kayleen McCaw, who is currently appearing in Lettuce and Lovage at the Players Theater in Sarasota, Florida. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
That you can be by discovering all that you really are. Some people might think this is confusing, counterintuitive. How can we not be all that we really are? How can we be anything other than what we really are? But as a therapist, I see over and over again that people are living lives in which they are only a part of who they really are, using only a part of what is natural to them, demonstrating only a part of what is actually intrinsically theirs. How can this be? You might be asking that. Actually, I don't think you're asking that. It's occurred to me that if you are someone who really thinks that's not possible, if you are someone who thinks, listen, what you see is what you got, this is all there is, don't talk to me about something more than I am, than I don't know. If you're someone who feels like that, you're probably not listening to me. You probably find what I say upsetting, annoying, and I think threatening. So, if you're listening, the chances are good that you either believe or at least suspect, or maybe even just hope, that there is actually more to you than you have been able to use. And I think that is very definitely the truth. As a therapist, I see over and over, day in and day out, people who come in because they want to stop doing something that they can't seem to stop, or they want to start doing something that they can't make themselves start doing. And the ability to stop it or start it requires a quality they think they don't have. They're hoping that therapy is going to help them discover it or create it or build it or find it. But like the old axiom, it's so often right in their own backyard, in their own psyche. But they have very, very good reasons for being in denial for the fact that this quality, this ability, this tendency is actually already there. There are several ways to discover qualities about yourself which you may be in denial for. Some of them are more pleasant than others. You spot it, you got it way of discovering aspects of yourself is perhaps the least pleasant, but in some ways the most powerful. If you find that someone else, a person you barely know, or a person that you don't know why, but you really don't like, somebody who makes your skin crawl, you think, oh, that's a terrible person, or that person behaves in a terrible way, or that thing that person does, that's so ugly. If this is, you can feel this about a fictional character, you can feel this about a movie, someone you see in a movie, or a colleague, somebody you work with, but you don't know them very well, but you know you don't like them and you don't want to get to know them. Unfortunately, quite often, I do not say always, because I don't believe in always, but quite often, when you see a quality in someone that really makes you uncomfortable, it is because you also have the capacity to demonstrate that quality. But you learned, usually very young, and almost certainly you have no memory of how you learned it. You learned that this was a quality you better not demonstrate. Maybe you laughed out loud. You had a very exuberant, cackling kind of laugh. And people let you know in no uncertain terms that that was ugly or unattractive, or you got teased by it, or you got punished for it. Because sometimes, ridiculously, that does happen. So you learn to put a governor. I don't know if you know that term. It's an old term. They used it on gas pedals in cars. There was a governor. You could only push the gas pedal down so far, and then the governor stopped you, and you couldn't go any faster than that. Well, I like this term because I think that one of the ways that we manage to survive our childhoods is by putting a governor on those qualities which we came to see would be either embarrassing, humiliating, or even cause us pain and suffering. So in this case, suppose your family really came down on you about your laugh. It is possible that you not only suppressed the laugh, you suppressed the mouth, you know, that it didn't smile or giggle. And then maybe you even suppressed your ability, your sense of humor. And you came to know yourself as someone who just didn't find very much funny. You know, you just didn't see very much as humorous in the world. And people who had big belly laughs and really guffawed and really seemed to get off on stuff, and you found them really annoying and upsetting and embarrassing, and you didn't even want to know them. Well, there's a very good chance that there's a belly laugh in your belly. And you can't get it anymore. You can't enjoy life the way you were meant to. Now, I suppose that sacrificing your sense of humor although I think it's a terrible thing, may not actually alter your life as much as the suppression of some other qualities. For example, let's say you are outspoken. Or maybe there's another way this can go. Let's say you had a sibling who was outspoken, and your parents were judgmental of that sibling. And they would talk about that sibling as can't keep its mouth shut, always has an opinion, you know, it's a sort of a pain in the ass, you know. Maybe even there were harsher things. So you came to see that quality, the quality of forthrightness, the quality of outspokenness, the quality of I believe what I believe and I don't have to be shy about it, as unattractive or maybe even dangerous. Dangerous because other people won't like you. Dangerous because you might be punished for it. So you learn to keep your opinions to yourself. And as a result, your favorite words or phrases were, I don't care, whatever you want. No, it's all the same to me. It's okay. Sure, that's okay. Now, this might work in a lot of situations. But as I don't think I have to make this, I don't have to beat this point into the ground. If you can't lobby for what you want and what you need and what you believe, you can see how that can lead to a life where you get very little of what you need. You depend, as Blanche DuBois said, on the kindness of strangers. Generally speaking, such people depend on the kindness, or actually the, I don't know what the word is, opinions of their the people who are close to them. So you see a lot of wives sort of going along, not having opinions. And of course, a lot of these people, it's not just wives, I mean, men learn to do this one too. A lot of these people wind up in therapy suffering from depression. Not surprising. But they have a serious taboo against being assertive. And generally speaking, by the time such a particular way of being in the world has cemented itself, it's not only that they can't assert themselves, they don't have a clue what they want or what they need or what works for them. I've heard people say, you know, if my friends liked it, I liked it. If they didn't like it, I didn't like it. There was no me there. But of course there is a me there. There's a me in everyone. I'm fond of saying to such people, go spend 10 minutes with a 2-year-old. 2-year-olds are absolutely clear. They want to wear the pink shirt and not the tan shirt. They want to have the cookie. They don't want to have the whatever the other thing is. They want to be held. They want to sit down. They want to stand up. They want. There's no I'm not sure or I don't want or whatever you want or it doesn't matter to me. There's none of that in a 2-year-old. So, you know, the song You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, and it's about racial prejudice. You have to be carefully taught to hate the people your parents hate. But you have to be carefully taught to deny aspects of yourself. Because we come into this world with all with bright colors, with loud voices. We come in with a passionately clear sense of who we are and what we want and what we can do. And unfortunately, a lot of that stuff either doesn't work with our family of origin, or as I said a moment ago, we see other people demonstrating some of these qualities and how they are treated, and we learn to hide them. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I, of course, talk about this at length. I say that the qualities that you've decided are okay are not going to cause pain and suffering or scare you. These qualities, the ones that are, you know, what you see is what you got, I call them your cover story. And then all the other qualities, whatever it was that you had to hide, goes undercover. In my private practice, I have seen a number of people who were middle or youngest children, and in whose family the oldest child was difficult, outspoken, a discipline problem, all kinds of stuff, and came in for a lot of punishment. So the youngest child, watching this, learned to be shy, to be timid, to be frightened, to be anxious. And, of course, that's what they're presenting in therapy. They don't want to be timid. They don't want to be anxious. They don't want to be nervous. They don't want to be scared. And they created this cover story. While undercover, they have the courage, the outspokenness, the forthrightness that the older sibling also had. In the book, I created an exercise called the Family Pie. In it, you draw a circle and you divide the circle into the number of people who were in your family of origin. You can include a grandparent or an aunt or uncle if they lived with you. And you write the qualities that describe those people in every one of the pie pieces. And if, for example, you are one of those people who thinks of yourself as timid or shy or anxious, and you see in one of the other pie pieces that somebody else in your family, or maybe many people in your family, are outspoken, are courageous, are even daredevil, you can know that you have that quality as well. I believe that every quality that you see in that entire pie is a quality that belongs to your system. And if it belongs to your system, it belongs to you. Now, there are any number of really good reasons why we would deny a quality which actually belongs to us. And, of course, I talk about that at length in the book. And hopefully I'm going to talk about that again in another show pretty soon. I'm just going to tell you a tiny example, not of why we would deny it and why it would be hard to recapture it, but I just discovered this in my own family. I have a brother who's a tease. He makes up things. When you ask him a question, he'll give you an answer, and he's made it up. And I have quite often found that annoying. And I commented on it the other day, and he said, well, you know, that's because you're so literal. And I thought, oh, my God, that's correct. I am very reluctant to give an answer that's other than the truth as I know it. I mean, I'm not, you know, I have this belief that that's the better way to be. And I'm quite sure that my brother developed this capacity to invent things in response to my over-literalness. We created a balance. And I think that's what families are always doing. If you look at your family pie, if you were to do it, my guess is that you will see balance. You will see some people acting in some way and some people acting in the opposite. Families are about creating balance. And so my brother balanced my literalness with his illiteralness. And I've been thinking about it and thinking that maybe I need to lighten up a little bit in terms of how precise I have to be. Maybe I can be a little more flippant. We'll see. So, If you want more information about this, you can go to my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. The book is up there, the workbook, the audio book. There's even an audio chapter one that you can listen to. If you're interested in psychotherapy, I currently do all my work on the phone, and I wrote an article called Psychotherapy on the Go. So if you're curious about that, you can read the article. If you want to talk to me about that, there's a place to email me. And if you email me, I will email you back, and we can talk about that. Also, on the website are all the interviews that I have done for all of my shows. And today is, just like all the other ones, I'm going to play an interview. This time, I'm playing an interview with Kayleen McCaw. Kayleen is the quintessential theater person. I think there's virtually nothing you can do in the theater that Kayleen can't do. And yet, she spent much of her adult life not being in the theater. It's a really interesting story of a woman who started out with the nickname Broadway in high school because she was so involved in the theater. And but what you hear in Kayleen's story is that she has a very powerful connection to who she is, and she knows it at every given moment. It's a really interesting and unusual story of someone who could do many things, often chose not to do them and do other things that she could do. And here she is back in the theater, this time as costumer, actor, performer, producer in the community theater in Sarasota, Florida, the Players Theater, where she is currently appearing in Lettuce and Lovitch, and she will talk about that, and also her interesting and circuitous journey. So here now, Kayleen McCaw.
So I'm here with Kayleen McCaw in the ladies' dressing room of the Players Theater, which we have to ourselves, fortunately. And I haven't actually described it. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that that at least the overarching art to which you have given your life is theater. Mm-hmm. And so I know you as an actor and as a costumer and even as a producer.
What? I'm nodding. I realize that doesn't show up on tape.
That's right. Right, right. When I do video. Right. Okay, good. She said yes. Right, right. Okay. So, I only ask one question, mm-hmm. and that is, how did it begin? And I mean the very first moment in life mm-hmm. when stories, acting, performance, theater, clothing... Mm-hmm. said, you're shaking your head again, so I guess that you understand what I'm saying,
right.
So what?
Well, my mother dabbled in theater. Her father was a professor of speech and debate, and her mother was the theater professor at the college where they all had their lives together. So I really didn't have a choice. You know, the things that I look back were just inculcated into me from the womb. The first thing my grandmother ever said to any of us was, by the shores of Gitche-Gumee, by the shining big sea waters, stood the wigwam of Nokonis and his lovely Indian daughters. And my mother tells a story about my oldest brother when he was little, hanging onto the edge of the table, learning to walk, sing, by the shores of Gitche-Gumee, by the shores...
Okay, so clearly you remember it. And when you got it and when you spoke it, were you applauded and congratulated, or it was just considered de rigueur, you know?
Well, some of each. Yeah, there was acknowledgement, because as it turns out that of the brood, I was the one who, you know, had the thing, and everybody else had more of a normal life. So in some ways, I was unfairly favored because I had the talents my mother wished I had. So, you know, there were doors opened before me, and she...
Oh, wait. So everyone got the same kind of training or inculcation or, right, of the, you know, how did they know you had the thing?
Because I just picked up the ball and ran with it, I guess. I saw the fire and I said, give me that, and I, you know, set fire to myself.
Can you tell me when you think the very first immolation was?
I think really, really young, just realizing how much power I had in our family structure by being amusing.
Ooh, lovely.
That was my power. I realized, okay, I can say anything I want to if it's obviously true and amusing. It's like, ooh, okay. I'm not going to get in trouble for speaking the truth if I speak it really, really well. Oh.
Or you make it funny.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So I was the youngest, so, you know, that's sort of the...
How many were there?
Four.
Four?
Yeah.
Other boys and girls?
Oldest boy, two in the middle, and then I was the youngest.
So, this is really kind of interesting. So, there were other girls you didn't say.
One more girl and then two boys. So we switched boy girl,
boy girl. Okay, so you were the baby girl, but yes. There was already a girl.
Right.
Right?
But she didn't take the spark. I was the first one who came along who really said, oh, that thing, I want that thing, I like that thing, give me that thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So from... Some of my first memories are being in the community plays at our meeting hall. It was a rural community. It's not that long ago, but it seems like longer because it was in the middle of nowhere. So we had a, what did they call it? Well, anyway, it was a community hall where all the farm families would come together and have periodic festivals and put on a Christmas show and a spring show and
right,
have...
Right. That was the entertainment for the community.
It really was. This is long before videotapes. Or, you know, and we got... I mean, out in the country, we got two channels, and you were at the... You know, there was one peanut special once a year, and if you missed it, that was it. You know, so we learned to entertain ourselves, and I was always in those shows.
Do you remember some of the early shows? Some of the early things you did?
Oh, gosh. Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, you know, really, really high tone stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but you were out there, right?
Yeah.
And everybody was going, hooray.
And the first thing that I really got put into as an opportunity, it must have been some kind of a summer show. It was, we had a wonderful professional theater program at the college in our town, Whitman College, professional theater training. And they had a summer camp where they... basically put on a show with a bunch of kids, and my mom said, okay, you want to do this, you know, go do this. So there wasn't a lot of money to go around, so for them to actually pay for me to have that experience was, in retrospect, pretty remarkable.
And how old were you?
11.
Yeah. So it's not only that you had the spark, you said, I want that thing, but at least your mother wanted it for you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what you were referring to earlier about that... It's sort of in the family, but nobody actually picked up that ball before.
Right.
But they were waiting for somebody
to
pick it up.
So it was like, hot dog.
Yes, we got one.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you did this summer camp thing,
mm-hmm.
and I'm assuming that kind of cemented it for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and it started, we always had season tickets to the college theater and to the community theater, and we were members of the community theater. So I was always had the opportunity to go to the theater, even in this you know, rural community.
It's really interesting because it's a real dichotomy, isn't it?
I mean,
in rural and farm families, and then you have this college that has a commitment to theater.
Right.
That is kind of odd.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting, I don't know, juxtaposition of two very different things. I would have assumed in my ignorance that a college in what is essentially a rural area wouldn't have done that, and if they did, they wouldn't get very much attention.
Mm.
But they did, and they did, right?
Right. Well, the rural community is the support structure, and in the midst of that, there was this oasis of culture. I mean, you go back there, now it's wine country, it's a golf destination, vacation spot. It's this gorgeous little place in the middle of the mountain. So naturally people walking by say, hey, that's a nice place to be. Sort of like what happened with Sarasota.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who doesn't want to move to paradise?
No,
so it becomes a cultural capital. Not that long ago, it was just a place to grow oranges.
I know. I know.
The same thing sort of happened in Walla Walla, which is where I'm from.
So, okay, so this is the very first, what was it? Do you remember it? What you did in the summer theater? Thing?
It was a hipped-up version of Little Red Riding Hood. you know, those horrible things they write for children. They try to make it cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I got the part of Little Red, by golly. And I had to say the most humiliating line. I was, you know, I was, I'm too busy with necking and petting to be sweating over reading.
Are you still blushing?
I am. I'm so horrified that I had to say such a thing.
And how did your family...
I didn't care.
Tease you? Oh, no, they didn't.
Yeah. Right.
Oh,
okay, so then what was next after that?
Well, just an interest in what was available. You know, school, you're always doing shows.
Right, right.
And, you know, I always found my way to the front of the line because I'm not shy.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if you...
Well, you had all the support.
Right.
Exactly. That this is a good thing, you can do it, you should do it, that, you know.
Right. Yeah, it never occurred to me that I couldn't or shouldn't or wouldn't.
Right.
So
yeah. That I want to make that point. I make it as often as it comes up, that there really is nothing like support from the family.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's essential, and if you don't have it, it's such a struggle.
Yeah.
But
yeah, and that's the most important thing, because my whole family is a dichotomy. You know, my father was from a family farm, and I was trained to be an engineer, was an engineer in the Navy, had, you know, all those opportunities available to him, but he went back to the family farm because that's what he was going to do.
Right.
You know, that's who he was. So both my parents were these very educated, sophisticated people in very simple circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out of that, the central message is that life is about personal success. It's about internal success. You know, that what you do in life is become a better person in life.
Right.
That your goal should be, you know, finding your bliss.
Right.
Doing what works for you.
Yeah.
So I was never, you know, shoved into doing any... There are lots of things I could have done, but, you know, I always knew that I was supposed to be happy.
Well, wow. That's so interesting. I thought you were going to say... I always knew I was going to be a performer, but you didn't. You said I always knew I was going to be happy.
Yeah.
And that idea that one does what one is meant to do, that one does what's right for one, and that is where happiness is.
Right.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely and rare, I think.
Yeah, and that I've made a point of raising my kids up that way too. You know, it's like that. Everything will sort itself out, but you'll know where to go by, you know, the message of your heart.
Right. You'll know where to go by the message of your heart. A pillow.
Right? Or something, right?
A banner. Okay, so you do everything there is to do in high school, and what happens?
Right. Well, after... you know, a few big shows in high school. I was the president of the drama club and all of these things, and they called me Broadway. And, you know, I look back, it's like, oh, God, I was young. You know, brash and big and bold, and it was fun.
That was wonderful.
Exciting. Yeah, it was terrific. And, you know, and then you graduate, and it's like, I don't know what the heck comes next.
Yeah.
That's the other side of being given complete freedom to do whatever works for you, is there's no structure laid out in front of you. I always just picked up whatever I found in my hands and ran with it.
Right.
So
well, and there were continually things given to you in your hands.
Right.
That's the thing, is that they kept offering them, or they were there, and you could pick them up and run with them.
Right.
And then there's not.
Yeah.
Right. Then you have to create it, find it, make it, earn
and
it,
I did not have the mental structure, the kind of drive to go out and make a professional career for myself. And I didn't have the smarts to find somebody to have the drive for me. You know, so
it's probably not smarts, but whatever it was,
I wasn't made that way.
Right.
You
right.
Know? And now I mean, I don't regret that. I really feel like the true meaning of amateur, you know, done for love,
mm-hmm. Right.
It infuriates me that word is used as an insult, because I believe it's the highest form of the art. And that's why what we do here at this community theater is so important.
Right.
We allow people who have maintained that tender place of love in their heart to share it with the world. I can't tell you how often I go to professional theaters and I'm just sad, because no one on stage is having any fun. No one's soul is in the game. You know, nobody's actually got themselves in the deal. It's something they got to do for a paycheck. And
right.
that's an affront, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's the opposite of what you were trained to do, right? I mean,
exactly.
It's the opposite of what we were talking about. And, wow, okay, good. So what did you do instead? Oh, everything, nothing. I've had a great variety of non-career jobs. Honestly, I did not settle into a path until, oh my Lord, I must have been 30-something.
Mm-hmm.
I came to Florida, got married, had my children, had a whole bunch of adventures that, some good, some bad, you know, mm-hmm. lots of adventures, life happened. Well, I'll tell you, went through an ugly divorce, mm-hmm. had twin girls, realized, you know, it was going to be impossible for me to continue homeschooling, which I'd done, had to get on with my life, you know, thank God I got rid of him. It's like, now what do I do? And Michelle Pingle, who is now our managing director, it is my next door neighbor, lives right across the street. And I had literally just walked my kids to school, put them in the first grade, said, all right, literally threw up my hands and said, okay, what am I supposed to do now? And Michelle drives by, rolls down her window and says, there's an opening at the Players and you need to put in your resume. I said, okay.
Ask and ye shall receive.
Exactly. I've always kind of followed that voice. So she, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about this place. They were willing to bring me in as the costumer because somebody knew that I sewed. That's all they knew about me. They didn't have any idea that I had a theater background. Nobody knew I acted for a couple of years until somebody said, hey, you know, you want to do this thing? So it's just been an organic process of being allowed, again, to follow my interests, to follow my abilities. I mean, recently I've taken on the role of grant writer, of coordinating the backstage theater project, so that there will be a home for the other kind of theater than what we do on the main stage.
Right.
You know, and I was allowed to simply rise to the occasion because I felt I was made for it.
Yes.
You know, that's the beauty of this place. So now we're creating this little incubator where edgy, small, exciting, challenging theater can happen. And the actors who would rather do that can come to the backstage. And the theaters who would rather watch that can come to the backstage and aren't excluded from the Players because we're all about big, splashy musicals.
Yeah. Talk to me about the costuming.
Mm-hmm.
What you do, how you do it, how it evolved.
Well, as I say, it started from just, you know, being
right.
able to sew. And I'd always had an interest in different fashion periods, you know, the historical aspect. So where it begins is you look at the script and find out when it's set, first of all, because that tells you the general way that things have to look. And do research on the period and how, you know, an average woman, an average man, how a person in this position would look. And then look at the script to find out what kind of people they are, you know, and how you indicate that personality with the clothes. I taught a little class to some of our summer camp students a while back, and, you know, I'd never really been asked to share that. So what I came up with, I went to the dictionary to find out what costume means. And it very literally means everything that you wear and everything you carry with you, including your hair and your makeup. It's like, okay. So I sat down with the kids and said, well, okay, so that's what a costume is. So what does my costume tell you about me? And we do that in reverse when we're costuming people in a play. It's like, and somebody says, you know, this is dumb, but it means you're a girl. It's like, absolutely, yes. That's the first thing. Do I go to the closet with the clothes for women, or do I go to the closet with the clothes for men?
Right.
And it's really very fundamental that way, but then builds into an art form. What does it tell you? Well, it tells you that the weather's warm, because mm-hmm. I'm not wearing, you know, something to keep me warm. It tells you that this is a pretty casual setting, because I don't have stockings or heels. You know, it tells you a lot.
Oh, yeah. It says a lot about your interesting color.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And
still you're wearing a necklace that's not real pearls, but is, right?
Yeah, rose quartz. Yes.
What is it?
It's rose quartz.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yes. And,
yeah, so you those details
right, are about you and who you are and what it says about you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is what I put onto the actors who go on our stage. I tell you, what's really wonderful is to be with somebody at that moment where they realize that the costume takes them a step further into their character.
Yeah.
You know, I've had that experience where somebody just hasn't been able to find this other person, and then you put on the wig, it's like, oh, there she is.
So, and here am I.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like costume supports character.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really what it's all about. And then on the next level of that, you paint just pretty pictures for people to look at. But, you know, I am fundamentally the other kind of customer. You know, it's
you're character-driven.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that would make sense, right? With
yeah.
your interest in character.
Right? Okay. Yeah. All right, so one day somebody said, why don't you do this? What was this as an actor?
You said, well, the first role I played in Florida in this new chapter of my life, it was a new play. We have our new play festival. It was one of the first versions of that, and actually another costumer had written a play, which was basically one more retelling of Romeo and Juliet in India, called A Roar of Tigers. Sorry. Feel free. So she didn't know I was an actress. She said, "Well, you're a mother. You could probably play the mother." And I wowed him.
Yes, right. And he said, "Oh my God!
Oh, where did she come from?" Right. She took credit, of course.
Yes. It's like I discovered Kaylee.
And then it went on that way for a while. Somebody dropped out of The Most Happy Fella. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, "Well, hey, you know, what about her?" And I came in and sang, and they said, "Oh my God, I love you!" And so it's very nice to just be invited to take roles. And finally, at some point, I started auditioning and have been sort of a regular on our stage here.
Well, and also at Home Resource.
Yes,
yes. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the play that you're about to do here.
Okay.
Well, actually, no. Let me say, I have seen Kaylene in this. God, was it Strindberg?
Yes, A Taste of Strindberg.
Right, A Taste of Strindberg. And I've seen you, of course, in Night Mother. Mm-hmm. And both of them are quite serious.
Yeah.
All the pieces, the Strindberg pieces, were serious, edgy, dark. And, of course, Night Mother is the poster child.
Yeah. The quintessence of dark.
Exactly, right. And so how did you feel about that? And do you particularly like that? Because I know Lettuce and Lovitch is maybe on the other end of the continuum.
Right. Mm-hmm. I need doses of both, mm-hmm. as I think we all do. I do like a good tragedy. I feel like it's good for you, like, you know, bitter herbs in the spring. It cleans your liver.
Is that from the farm thing? Is that from your history?
No, it's just a knowledge of herbs.
I never heard that.
That's true. Yeah, that's why people used to take their spring tonic. Mm-hmm. Spring tonic is all full of bitter herbs, which then in the northern climates, you know, during the winter you're eating old stuff, you're eating, you know, a lot of starches, you're just trying to stay alive, and then
right.
when the fresh things begin to come back in, when spring
comes
around.
Oh, you have to clean all that other stuff out.
Yeah, you flush yourself so you can start new.
Ah, very nice.
And that's what that's about.
Essentially, spring cleaning for the body.
Precisely what it is. And I feel like there's, you know, a purpose for that in theater. So somebody who came to see Night Mother said the most beautiful thing when she was talking about it afterwards is you go to theater so that you can leave different than when you came in. See, I love the opportunity to do that kind of theater. I mean, the idea that my work, and I mean, you don't do tragic things without personal sacrifice. I mean,
no.
What it takes to go to that place, you're putting a lot on the line, and you don't come away unchanged. I mean, you know, you got some flesh in the game to play a role like that. And it's the knowledge that is a real gift that somebody's able to receive in the audience and grow from it. And be better and stronger and, you know, truly uplifted in some way from it. That to me, that's what it's all about.
Wow.
I'm one of those. You know, I really see theater as sacred.
Well, yeah, I agree. I don't think everybody sees it that way. And I also don't think that every play has to be that. But I do think that, as you say, it has a place.
It has the possibility to be that. And that's, you see that in this building. We've got the little room in the back, you know, the cave, where you go for, you know, the ritual and the ceremony and to really stir things up and come out different. And then you got the big happy room where you dance and have a party. And that's, you know, that's a little more Lettuce and Lovitch.
And all are necessary.
I believe so.
Yeah, okay. All right, so we've been mentioning Lettuce and Lovitch, which you are about to be in.
Yes.
With Pam Wiley. Oh, okay, so tell me about it, can you?
Yeah, Lettuce and Lovitch. Lettuce Dufay is a British lady of a certain age. When we meet her, she is a tour guide. She grew up with her single mother, who ran an all-girl French language Shakespeare troupe. It takes a little thinking.
Yes.
In the Dordogne in France. So they toured, and Lettuce was the stage manager and the costumer and choreographed all the fights.
Oh, okay.
So at this point, she's a tour guide in what turns out to be one of the dullest houses in England. And she simply cannot bear to keep reciting the facts about the house, which are not very interesting facts, because she sees the tourists come in and they begin to turn gray and tune out and yawn and cry.
Glaze over.
And one day she just decides to give them more for their money than the facts and begins to tell stories about how wonderful it would have been if the history had been better and to enhance and to make theater for the people instead. So the other Pam Wiley's character is Lottie, not Lovage. Lovage is something else, who's from the business that runs the tours, comes in and fires her for making up stuff.
Right.
And afterwards, they become fast friends. Let us wince her over to a more interesting way of life. And adventures ensue. I don't want to
spoil the story. No, don't. Lettuce and Lovage is a charming, delightful, interesting play with two wonderful, beautiful, talented actors.
Yes.
And it's opening, it will run the last weekend in June.
Right.
And the last weekend in July at the Players Theatre. Okay, good. The other question I ask is, if you could think about you've already talked about this, about the time that you've given to theater in your life, and what you would want to say about doing that, about dedicating large chunks of your life to the theater.
Well, you've got to have something. And whether you consciously choose to have something or not, you have something. You know, maybe it's TV for a lot of people. You know, maybe it's worrying about money for a lot of people. For some people, it's the church. For some people, it's their kids.
Something, meaning something that matters to you or that you invest in.
A focus for your energy.
A focus for your energy. I got it. Okay, good.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to serve somebody.
Yeah.
And I went a lot of years without theater in my life, and they were stale years. Theater is this microcosm for the universe. You know, I honestly feel what we're doing in life is living stories so that when we pass out of physical reality, we get to tell them. I mean, I really believe that that's what we're here for. We are collecting stories so that beings on some higher level can watch. I really do.
We are theater.
We really are theater.
We are
somebody else. I truly do believe this.
That's great. Well, when you have that perspective, then it really matters what you do.
Exactly. And it's knowing that I choose what I do, regardless of what it looks like.
Right.
That I am writing this story, and my ultimate job is to write a really good
story.
And really good stories have some scary parts and some parts where you just don't know if it's going to turn out all right. But, you know, if it's a good story, it also has a resolution at the end. So you can't be worrying about that. I mean, I am in the middle of a really cool story, and that's my job.
I love this. I just love this. The through line from what we were talking about earlier about what your parents did. They knew the story that their life was supposed to tell. And so even though they seemed to have they diverted from it to some extent, they had a through line. They had a strong sense of who they were supposed to be and the story they were supposed to be telling with their life.
Yeah.
And I do think that, I think that's just lovely. And I think that lots of people don't have that perspective.
Probably not.
No. I mean, seriously, that lots of people feel rootless.
Yes.
You know, meaningless even, right?
Yeah. We are at a juncture, you know, in history where our old stories aren't doing it for us anymore.
Yeah.
And we've got to tell ourselves better stories. Stories are how we connect to that which is larger than ourselves. You know, and there was a time when everybody was happy with the story about Jesus, and, you know, it was a great story. And it still could be a great story if we told it better.
Right.
But we don't know how to tell that story anymore. So we need to look out at the new information and tell stories about energy and waves and atoms and formlessness and possibility. And science is telling us those stories.
Yes.
They're telling us what's possible. So it's our job now, our responsibility, to take hold of that and say, ah, okay, let me tell you. That's something Lettice says. You know, it's just like, ah, let me tell you, is to receive that knowledge and reflect it in its highest form.
Yeah, but that requires the willingness to let go of the old story.
Yes.
And lots of people, most people, are kicking and screaming.
Yeah, it's a hard one.
Yeah. But the other thing that occurs to me, which is sort of apropos of nothing, but that when you talk about the kinds of things that science is now opening our eyes to the possibilities of, the other thing that's going on is that there's a generation now that has been raised with technology in a way that, that their parents weren't.
Yeah.
You know, and even some of their older siblings weren't. I was at a restaurant the other day and there was a child that could have been more than four who grabbed the cell phone off her parents' desk to take pictures of my dog.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was, she's not going to have any difficulty with this brave new world that she's entering. But what this makes me think of is people who emigrate from a country to a country where they don't speak the language, don't know the customs, and then they have children who are raised in the new country, mm-hmm. and there's that tug of war between the generations.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people are going to be unpleasantly surprised because their stories aren't accepted, grasped.
Well, right. Yeah, and that's a natural part of of believing your story is
right.
you want it to be heard.
Right.
You want it to
and
be
you want
told.
It to be right.
Exactly. I was a big part of the right-wing church for a while. You know, it's something I passed through, and I don't regret it because, you know, I learned something. And then I said,
right.
Wow, okay, that's done, and I moved on. You know,
this from a woman who's doing stories for beings?
Well, you know, it was part of the journey.
I got it.
I did it balls to the wall.
Oh,
you know, it's, I'm going to follow
Jesus. The way you do everything, right?
Exactly.
Right.
I'm going to follow Jesus. And then
right.
there came a point where it's like, well, Jesus isn't doing what the church is doing, so we're going to go
over here. Right.
And that's basically how that ended. And so, you know, I don't feel like I stopped that. I was just like, wow, okay, I had to part company with
with a particular story.
With a version of the story.
Right.
You know, the telephone game. You know, Jesus.
Oh, yeah, right.
Jesus was with us for a while, and he hung out with 12 guys, and he told
stories. And then they got turned, and they got passed
and
on,
got,
and passed
got
on,
passed
and they got passed on.
And
somebody
said, well, you know, gosh, it will benefit me if I emphasize in this story that men have ownership over women.
Exactly.
You know, it
right.
will benefit me if I tell the story in this way, and we lost track of the beginning,
of
the essence of it.
Right.
We could tell that story again.
Yes, we could.
In a beautiful way. You know, Jesus was a man.
Yes.
If he was something other than a man, then his words don't make any sense. He told us, do what I did.
Right.
He wouldn't have said that if it wasn't possible.
Right, right.
You know, so there could be beauty and grace and wonder in that. But we got to be willing to say, okay, where do we go from here? We have to be willing to walk off the map.
Yeah. Be willing to walk off the map. That, it seems to me, is, and I agree with that entirely, the willingness to look inside yourself, to be to accept what you find there, even if it isn't what other people say it should be or everybody else is doing, or it's a story that's different from the stories that other people around you believe in or are telling, and that is where you know, know thyself and all that. Right. That is where an unexamined life isn't worth living.
Exactly.
You know, I believe all of that, and most people are struggling with that. That to, what did you say, jump off the map?
Yeah, walk
up the edge of the map requires something that most people didn't get in their childhood.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and that's something that I you know, peruse sometimes. Is, I mean, that really is the greatest gift I feel like I got from the way I was raised. Just the true, deep freedom. And
to be yourself.
To be myself.
Yeah, right.
To be myself. And, you know, in some ways, there was a certain horror in the landscape of growing up on a farm. You know, you're surrounded by... We raised animals, and they die, and, you know, we don't have a lot of resources. So, you know, you see their bodies rotting, and you see the life cycle in all of its splendor.
Right.
But you see it. And you know it, and you embrace it, and it's normal.
You don't run from it.
Exactly. You can't.
Right.
You know, you might try, but it's there. You know, the end is present in the beginning. So you accept on a very deep level that endings and beginnings are related.
Right.
And in the course of my life, I've gone through at least 3 major times where I had to say, okay, everything I know is wrong. Now what?
Yes.
And I'm so... grateful. That's all I can say. I mean, I'm so much better for that.
Yeah.
For having...
Because you could say, what now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not, oh my God, everything is wrong, I have to give up now.
Right.
Right.
Because there's going to be a way.
Yeah.
If there's not a way, then the story is a lie. And how can it be? It's my story.
I love that, and I think this is a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Kayleen.
Oh, thank you.
So, there you have Kayleen McCaw continually creating her story, as I hope each and every one of you are. I would like to say a lot more about this, but I have managed to run us right up to the end of the show. So... I'm going to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do, for all the things that I always thank him for, and tell you that I hope you heard something you can use from this show, as I always do. I hope you heard something that intrigued you or made you curious, something you didn't know, something that made you laugh, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I certainly hope you will be.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't.